Okay, we take up now the next step in our story of the Bible. We have talked about Hebrew Bibles, we've talked about Aramaic and Syriac and Greek a lot, and now we're going to talk about Latin. And if you look at the history of the Christian church in the Western world, the Greek translation, of all the translations, almost certainly the Greek has been the most influential, but the Latin comes close behind. And so this is the story of the history of the second most influential translation in the history of Christianity. And we'll run through the story here. The official language of Rome was always Latin. It was used in the military. It was used by merchants. But the scholarly language of the Roman Empire for most of its history and the language of early Christianity was almost always Greek. As we noted, the Christian message had an explosive growth in its early centuries, and it was based, and this is a key point that we want to keep emphasizing until hopefully you all get it, the Christian movement was based on a message. And that message was encapsulated and written out in a form of what we call the Bible. And each believer, therefore, wants to hear it in his own language. If he can't read it, he wants to at least hear it in his own language. When Constantine moved from Rome to Constantinople around AD 425, he left a... that's an error. It should be 325. Yeah, see, I needed Gordon to edit this. He probably wouldn't even have found that. He left a power vacuum at Rome. In Constantinople, the cooperation between the emperor and the patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox churches cemented the use of the Septuagint translation in Greek. And now the Septuagint covers how much of the Bible? The Old Testament. Let's make sure we get that clear. We talk about the Septuagint, we're just talking about the Old Testament. So for 1,000 years, they used the Septuagint translation as they understood it. And we talked last time about how it got modified and Origen did his thing. And a lot of people were using that fifth column from Origen and so forth. But the hodgepodge things that came out that came to be regarded as the sort of standard Greek translation called the Septuagint, although it wasn't really the original Septuagint, that was their Old Testament. And then their New Testament was a straightforward Koine Greek, in which the New Testament was originally written. That is, insofar as it was copied accurately, as you all recognize the challenges of that. So, but back in Rome, in the Eastern Empire, what's called the Orthodox churches in our day, those group of peoples, what they stuck with was that Greek. And that's what they regarded as their Bible. But in Rome, changes were taking place. All the early Christian books written to or from Rome were in Greek. I mean, it was the language of scholarly exchange in those days. It wasn't till around the year 200 AD that Christian scholars began to write significant things in Latin. There are some hints that the first Latin translations were made in the Eastern Mediterranean. We don't know if that's really true, but there's some hints. But it wasn't long before the center, and notice this very interesting thing here, the center of Latin Christianity was in North Africa around Carthage. So even though technically Latin is the official language of the Roman Empire, centered in Rome, in the early days of Christianity, of course, remember Rome was also the center of persecution of Christians in those early years. So the center of Latin Christianity was actually in Carthage in North Africa, and Carthage was always more or less in animosity with Rome, so maybe the Christians felt more comfortable down there where they were a little bit more removed from the power of Rome. I don't know. Many people spoke both Latin and Greek because, of course, if you were a scholar, you spoke Greek, and if you did any business or if all the normal things, you would do that in Latin. So, of course, it was a common language. Both of them were common languages. So early in the stages of the Latin translations, they were I mean, people didn't think about them as something officially that someone sat down and made a translation from Greek to Latin. Now, notice, in the Old Testament now, we're talking about a translation of a translation. When they're translating from the Septuagint, what's the original language of the Old Testament? Hebrew. So we've already come from Hebrew to Greek, and now people are coming, and Hebrew's become almost a non-spoken language. It's a language just preserved by a special group of people, relatively few people, certainly very, very few of the Christians, the new Christians, had any idea about Hebrew at all. And so now they are taking the Greek Old Testament and the Greek New Testament, and the people who know, feel comfortable with both Latin and Greek, are just sort of given their free translations of the Greek into Latin. And so, and some of them are writing them down. So pretty soon, they're circulating around 9 different variations of the Latin Bible. Yes, Joanne. Or maybe I shouldn't say the Latin Bible. I should say 9 variations of Scripture translated by whoever into Latin. Yes.
Could the ordinary people be translating now because writing materials were accessible to them, and so then they could participate in this rather it being the exclusive prerogative of rich people?
Much more so. Yes, that's correct. Paper, well, you know, papyrus-based kind of documents were becoming more and more readily available. It was a lot easier to for more or less ordinary people to have access to these, and that was another part of the total story. So, just before the year AD 200, the New Testament was available in North Africa in Latin, and probably by around AD 250, the entire Bible was available in some kind of Latin. And we'll talk about how good this Latin was in a moment. There's pretty good evidence that some of these earliest Latin translations came from a Greek that was prior to the days of Origen. Remember, Origen is working about this same time, and he did that huge document we talked about last time with 12,000 pages of stuff with 6 translations side by side and trying to get the very best Greek version of the Old Testament that he could possibly produce. And so some people were using that 5th column as their Greek Bible. Some people were using the Old Septuagint as their Bible. Some people were using Aquila. Some people were using Symmachus. Some people were using Theodotion. And so it became a little confusing because now you have multiple versions of the Greek being translated into many multiple versions of Latin. So you can see how things would become a little bit confusing. You quote somebody, thus and so says the Lord, and he says, my Bible didn't say that. I heard it a different way. So who's got the authority to speak now?
So now, like today, we have people with the different English translations, and that's why they want all the old King James, because they can't wrestle with the different English translations.
And this was becoming a real problem. And so, in the contrast to the Greek of Constantinople, which was pretty much standardized now, Rome was becoming increasingly Latinized. Now, let's not pretend that Latin is some kind of a hick language. We know famous scholars that names you've all heard of are writing in Latin. There's Cicero and Caesar and Virgil and Ovid and others. So it's not like Latin wasn't a sophisticated language. It just wasn't regarded as a language of scholarship because of the heritage of our friend Alexander the Great and so forth. But among Christians, we need to recognize even the earliest recognized bishops of Rome all had Greek names. I mean, you weren't even anybody if you didn't have a Greek name. Finally, around AD 190, Pope Victor I, if we can really call him a pope, began writing theological treatises in Latin. So this is one of the earliest things where official documents were actually written apparently directly in Latin. One of the earliest Christian documents in Latin was a story of the Acts of the Cilician Martyrs. A very interesting thing is a first-hand account of an actual trial of 7 Christian men and 5 women before a Roman procurator in the town of Scilly, who were forced to choose either to recognize an image of Caesar as a god offering an incense, or death, and they chose death. And the story was written entirely in Latin. And so you can see how the Latin now is beginning to meet the needs. I mean, if I'm trying to convince you to become a Christian, and you know, as I'm in the process of doing that, that becoming a Christian could be a life-threatening situation, that you could die for your Christianity, then what kind of stories are you going to be talking about? You're going to be writing hero stories about people who give their lives for Christianity, right? And here now, those stories are starting to appear in Latin. One of the very first Christian documents in Latin is the story of these martyrs. Not long after that, Tertullian, and many of you, I'm sure, have one time or another heard of Tertullian, of Carthage again. Remember now, this is still a time when Christianity, not consistently, but up and down, is going through terrible times of persecution. Christianity is not an official religion yet. We've gone forward to the time when Christianity was official, when we were talking about the Greek language, but we're now back talking about the times when you could die for being a Christian. But Tertullian of Carthage wrote his voluminous apologies in Latin. What is an apology? A Christian apology. What does that mean when we say apology? Yeah. Joanne is going to help us. Go ahead.
A defense of the faith?
Sure. It's basically, if someone attacks you on any subject, and you sit down to make an official reply defending your position, that's called an apology. It's not, I'm sorry I did that, you know, it's come to have that sort of modern meaning, but apology in the more traditional meaning here is you're sitting down, you're writing out a defense, and Tertullian was taking on all the enemies of Christianity and just really trying to respond to all their accusations. And he wrote and wrote and wrote. And one of the interesting things about Tertullian's writing is that he quite often quotes from a Bible in his writings, and clearly it's in Latin because he's writing in Latin. So presumably he was using some kind of a Latin Bible or Latin Bibles, plural, as he's writing his apologies. So soon, as we already have mentioned, there were many different translations and versions. Joanna.
What did people think of his writings? Were they
they're good.
Substantial? Were they...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Tertullian was one of the great champions of the faith back in the early days. Some versions contained passages of the Bible which others didn't include. And I don't know exactly whether these were oversights or whether, you know, someone says, well, I'm just not going to translate that part. I mean, if you're doing it for yourself, nobody says that you have to translate the whole thing carefully, scientifically, scholarly, in a scholarly manner. You translate what you feel like. And so there are significant portions where there's just big chunks left out. Okay. So, you know, but if you're trying to produce a Bible for the benefit of an entire church, you don't want big chunks left out. Unfortunately, no complete manuscript of the Old Latin, and that's what it's now called, all those random translations that people made have come to be known collectively as the Old Latin. And no complete version of the Old Latin is in existence today. We have the Old Latin version of wisdom. Now, we'll talk about what has been preserved. We do have the Old Latin for these apocryphal books, the Wisdom of Solomon, Ecclesiasticus, Baruch, and Maccabees, preserved in the Vulgate because Jerome refused to recognize them as inspired and refused to translate them. So now we're going to start talking about the story of the Vulgate, but here's one of the first interesting things about the Vulgate. The Apocrypha of the Vulgate, much of it, wasn't even translated by Jerome. He refused to do it. So in the middle of Jerome's Bible that we're going to now talk about is a bunch of stuff that wasn't even done by him. Okay. We also have the Old Latin for, We also have the Old Latin for Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, up to chapter 20, Ruth, Esther, Tobit, the Psalms, only slightly revised, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. And considerable portions of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and of the prophets, but only a little of Samuel, Kings, Ecclesiastes, Job, and Proverbs. So you can see this old Latin that we're talking about here, we know quite a bit about it, but there's lots of stuff that we don't have. Jerry.
I'm kind of confused by that number 9 there where it says that Jerome, we have it because Jerome refused to recognize them as inspired and refused to translate them.
Okay, yes.
What was Jerome translating from and into?
Okay, well, that's the story of the rest of the hour. So hang on, because it changes. There's not a flat answer to that.
Well, but
in terms of this, what's happening here is people had become accustomed to using these, what we call apocryphal books, that people had translated for themselves in this what so-called Old Latin. Not a standard translation, just a bunch, and they were translating from the Greek. Is that what your question is?
Well, if we have them, but he wouldn't translate them, we have them in the Latin, but he didn't translate them into the Latin, mm-hmm. How did we get them?
They were part of the Old Latin. And so,
well, who translated that? I thought Jerome was the first one to translate.
No. There were all kinds of stuff here long before Jerome. That was part of the problem. There was this hodgepodge. People just translating what was sometimes called willy-nilly.
Okay, so we have it from other translators.
So Jerome says, if you want those books in your Bible, because he was now officially doing this on behalf of the Catholic Church, the
right.
quote Catholic Church. He said to them, if you want that as a part of your Bible, you can pick what you like and put it in there, but I'm not going to translate it for you because I don't believe it.
But we have it in spite of his refusal to translate.
We have it in his Bible, and we're going to find out there's other parts of the Bible that are like that also.
It's in the official Bible that he translated, but he didn't translate those.
That's correct. Yep. So we're going to start to see, you're going to start to see some very interesting stuff going on here. Okay? And it makes you wonder, you know, how do we regard this? Well, one of the important uses of the Old Latin today is for scholars, if they're sure that they actually have the Old Latin and not Jerome's translation, one of the important uses of that is to try to use that Old Latin to try to figure out what the Greek said. Because we're always trying to get back as far as we can, and so that's part of the challenge for scholars. Well, then came Jerome. Now, Jerome was born into a relatively wealthy family and received a great education. He was born at Stridon on the border of Dalmatia and Pannonia around AD 340. Later, he traveled to the east for about 4 years, spent 5 years in the desert of Chalcis in self-discipline, and finally undertook a thorough study of the Hebrew language under a former Jewish rabbi who had been converted to Christianity. So here's a man who enjoys studying. His family is independently wealthy. He moves in very high circles, probably because of his wealth. And he just sort of goes around and does whatever he feels like. He committed his life fairly early to celibacy, more or less. And so he's traveling. If he decides he wants to study Hebrew for a while, he just goes somewhere and finds someone that he thinks can teach him Hebrew, and he spends 3 or 4 years. I mean, you know, you don't have to work. You don't have to do any of those kind of things. You just move off and do what you want to do. So that's the story of Jerome's early life. Later, he traveled to the east for about 4 years, spent 5 years in the desert Caucasus in self-discipline, and finally undertook a thorough study of the Hebrews we just mentioned. During these years, he maintained a close contact with Pope Damasus, who happened to be a friend of his from his former days earlier. He maintained this contact through letters. In AD 379, he moved to Antioch. Another misspelling here. He moved to Antioch. He didn't move Antioch, where he was ordained. Then, while spending time at Constantinople, became familiar with scholarship there. And so you can see that this man is just freely moving around the Mediterranean world, getting familiar with things in different places, meeting scholars, talking to them about their concerns about different translations and so forth. So he's just getting himself a general education. Finally in AD 382, he went to Rome, where he spent more than 2 years in close association with the current Pope Damasus, his former friend. Now, Pope Damasus recognized the great scholarly abilities of Jerome. He officially asked Jerome to undertake a thorough new translation into Latin. So here you can see what's going on. Here's the head of the Latin church. He sees what's going on in the East. They have a nice Bible that everybody recognizes. There's not too much conflict over it. And they can speak with authority because they have their version. And here he is out in the West, and he's in charge of the Latin church. And there's all these different versions of Latin. Nobody knows for sure which one is right and so forth. And so Damasus just says, hey, Jerome, you've studied Hebrew, you've studied Greek, you've studied Latin, you know all this stuff. You obviously are a genius. Why don't you sit down and make us an official translation? And so, what happened? Well, Jerome began, as almost all new translators do, with a revision of the Gospels. And he did that pretty carefully and fairly quickly, which appeared around AD 383. This was followed in the next few years by the book of Acts and a revision of the rest of the New Testament, probably done by others, but closely supervised by Jerome. So now we're starting to see what's going on. We already know that part of the Apocrypha wasn't done by Jerome at all. Now we're seeing that everything after Acts in the New Testament is probably done by somebody else with a little bit of supervision by Jerome. So are you starting to get the picture here? Okay. The latter part of the New Testament grew increasingly close to the Old Latin. Revisions only being made to the Old Latin were required by the Greek text. And so these people who apparently were working sort of in conjunction with Rome said, well, this is pretty good. We'll just accept that. And he would say, no, you know, the Greek over here says this. You better fix this. And the Greek there says that. You better fix this. You better fix this. You better fix this. And so they did sort of a patch job on the rest of the New Testament instead of doing a new translation. Then Jerome turned to the Old Testament. Here he translated from the Septuagint, revising it only slightly from older Latin translations, and produced what came to be known as the Roman Psalter. Okay, now, I don't know why, but that doesn't really matter. Jerome loved the Psalms. And so he starts off in the Old Testament by translating the Psalms. Now, he's not translating from Hebrew yet, even though he knew Hebrew. He's translating from Greek into Latin, okay? And he uses whatever Greek translation versions he can find available, and he does this thing called the Roman Psalter. This Latin version of the Psalms is still used as the official version at St. Peter's Church at Rome and at Milan. So if you go to Rome and you listen to a service and they quote from the Psalms in St. Peter's Church, or you hear it on the air sometime, the Pope speaking, if he quotes from Psalms, it will be from this oldest translation of Psalms, done not from the Hebrew, but from the Septuagint, from the Greek, by Jerome. Yes, Larry. Hold on just a second.
Well, since he knew Hebrew, why did he not search out some Hebrew texts to translate it from original rather than from the Septuagint?
We're going to talk about that in a moment.
Was it an availability issue?
No, I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. He just...
It seems like going back to the original rather than...
Well, he's going to come to that, so bear with him for a moment. Pope Damasus died around 384. So Jerome's closest friend back at Rome was gone. And Jerome left Rome for Palestine. He spent about 5 years touring Palestine and Egypt and then established two religious houses at Bethlehem, one for monks and one for nuns, and he appointed a lady to be in charge of the one for nuns. During this time, and obviously again, remembering this guy is independently wealthy, he's just moving around sort of however he feels like it. During this time, probably around 83-87, Jerome again revised the Book of Psalms. Now, he hasn't done anything the rest of the Old Testament. Now he's doing Psalms the second time. This time using the Septuagint while carefully considering some of Origen's critical marks and produced the Gallican Psalter. Now, he did the Roman Psalter first. Now he's doing the Gallican Psalter, which got its name because it was first adopted in Gaul. This translation made from the Greek manuscripts, notice he's still translating from Greek, not from Hebrew, available to Jerome at the time, was adopted by the Roman Catholic Church and remains the official translation of the Book of Psalms. So if you go to any Catholic church and they're reading in Latin, when they come to Psalms, it will not be from the Latin, it will not be from the Hebrew into the Latin, it's from the Greek. So we went from Hebrew to some Greek. We've already talked about the challenges of that. And now it's gone in from Greek into Latin with help a la Origen and his fifth column and all these critical marks there and all that kind of stuff. So Jerome has now made an attempt to get the very best Greek that he can to make this second version or his second translation of the Book of Psalms. Jerome soon realized that when this, and now there's a problem arises. Jerome is listing, is living in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. These two special Christian places that he's established are actually in the city of Bethlehem. So he's, who are all the people around him? There are a lot of them are Jews. And so Jerome soon realized that when discussing the Old Testament with Jews, it did no good to appeal to the readings of the Septuagint, since they did not recognize it as being authentic. So you can't argue with a Jew about what it says in the Septuagint. Who cares what it says in the Septuagint? We have our Hebrew Bible. So you can see where immediately he's got a problem here. So he began to translate one Old Testament book at a time from the original Hebrew into Latin. Now we're finally getting direct Hebrew to Latin, sending copies to his friends. He began with the easier historical books of the Old Testament, Samuel and Kings. Okay? Now, let me stop. Well, let me read the rest of this paragraph, and then if you have any questions, I want to make sure that we're following the story here. This is around AD 390. Then he decided to do the Psalms once more, this time from the original Hebrew. But that version of Psalms was never officially adopted by the Catholic Church. Okay. The major and minor prophets were next, followed by Job, Ezra, and Chronicles. By the year AD 398, he had translated Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Songs. Then he took up the real challenge, the Pentateuch. Finally, in AD 404, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and Esther. So basically the man is sort of going through the Old Testament, and when he feels like doing a book, he does it. And there was a couple years when he was sick, so he didn't do any translation. And then, okay, I'm feeling better now, I'll do some more translation. And he would send these translations that he made to his friends, and they just sort of gradually got publicized like that. And as a sort of final appendix to his work, he translated the additional apocryphal portions of Daniel and Esther from... Now not from the Hebrew, because we don't have it in the Hebrew. He's now translated from the Aramaic. He also translated the books of Tobit and Judith, because he thought those were sort of interesting. But he refused to translate, as we've already mentioned, Wisdom of Solomon, Ecclesiasticus, Maccabees, and Baruch. Okay, any questions before we go into the last bit of what he does and how what kind of a conglom we ended up with in this Latin Bible? Yes. Mike, up there.
Maybe I missed it, but why again did he refuse to do Solomon, Ecclesiastes, and also why did he do these, was it Tobit and all these other guys?
He did the ones he believed in, and he refused to do the ones he didn't believe in. Basically, that was what happened. Yeah. No, that's what he did. The church believes it, but he doesn't believe it. So he says, I'm doing the translating here. If you like what I do, that's fine. If you don't like it, find somebody else to translate it. Yes.
Well, maybe like all humans, if he's rich and educated, he feels that he knows it all.
Well, I mean, that's possible. But let's, on the other hand, before we sort of jump on Jerome here, there's no question about the fact that in ancient early Christianity, the two men who had the biggest impact on the Bible as we know it in English today are Origen and his work with the Greek Bible and Jerome and his work with the Latin Bible. There is no question about it. These two men stand out as giants. Now, they have their problems, and there was some serious problems in the way their work was handled, as we're going to see in a moment. We've already read across the problems at hand of dealing with Origen's work in Greek. And now we're going to see the problems that came out in dealing with Jerome's handling of the Latin. Any other questions about where we are here? It gets a little bit confusing, so I want to make sure we've got at least this much nailed down. Okay. One might have felt that he would be praised for his long, arduous task. But instead, he got criticism from almost every side because, notice these very interesting comments, his new translation was different than what people were used to. Have we ever heard anything like that before? You know, don't you criticize my Bible. You know, it may not have anything to do with the real, what the Bible really said. It may not be from the original language, blah, blah, blah. I don't care. But that's what I'm used to, so you better leave it alone. That was the kind of attitude. And these were scholars. I mean, St. Augustine lived about the same time as Jerome. St. Augustine was a little ahead. But he had some very unfriendly things initially to say about Jerome's work. And Jerome got so tired of dealing with these criticisms coming from every side that he started, he had a hot temper and a sharp pen, as some scholars have said. And he would call these people who would write into him, he would write back, and he would write scathing things back to these critics of his. And he called them things like two-legged asses and all sorts of wonderful things. And this is the guy who translated one of the most important versions of the Bible ever produced. So, I mean, what do we do? This is real. That's the way things are. Joanne.
Pictures form in my mind. It's kind of interesting how God, we humans like to grab onto things, idols, words, and that sort of thing. And God is sending worship in times, the Sabbath, and he's sending ideas through the Bible. Mm-hmm. And us humans are grabbing on to the tangibles, and God seems to be sending the intangibles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very significant. So what's happening here, I hope I'm not destroying anybody's faith here, but what I am trying to do in a gentle way by telling you the real story of the Bible as far as I understand it, and I'm spending a lot of time reading books and even listening to DVDs on the subject and so forth. Dennis has a comment up there. Trying to present this as accurately as I can, but what I want you to recognize here is that, you know, the King James, contrary to some people's belief, didn't sort of descend amidst the showers of blessing from heaven as a perfect. I mean, I should have put more of that in here. You know, people, when they got used to the Septuagint in Greek, and when they got used to the Vulgate in Latin finally, they literally believed that God himself was responsible for this particular translation, and therefore, I mean, way down to the times of the Protestant Reformation, there were people saying this Latin was blessed by God, and it's more accurate than the original. That was their attitude. This is the version that's blessed by God, that God gave to us, and I don't care what the Greek said, I don't care what the Hebrew said, this Latin is the Bible blessed by God, yes.
Another book on the subject would be God's Secretaries. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have seen that one.
No.
About the translators of the King James Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these guys were just human beings that, yeah, you know, scholarly, but it's a great antidote for fundamentalism.
Yeah.
A gentle.
Yeah. Now, okay, Dennis.
Is it true that the King James Version is the most influential English language version,
yes,
of the Bible? Okay. That being so, what was the King James Version translated from? Did they lean heavily on Origen and Jerome, or did those translators go back to the original?
Okay. I give them credit for going back to the best Hebrew they had available and the best Greek they had available, which wasn't necessarily the best that we have available. In fact, it definitely wasn't the best available compared to what we have available today. They went back to pretty good stuff. It was reasonably reliable. Recognizing, now, let's be honest here. You're getting way ahead of the story, or quite a ways ahead of the story. But let's be honest here. 90% of the King James is verbatim from Tyndall. Okay? And what was Tyndall doing? Tyndall was trying to translate running from his enemies, hiding here, translating a little bit, running somewhere else, hiding and translating there, running somewhere else, hiding and translating there. That's where we got our King James Version. 90% of it. See? Now, do you think he was sitting down in a massive library with a computer in hand where he can compare all the different volumes? Don't kid yourself. He used what he had available. Yeah, Don.
We always hear of the King James Version as the authorized version, but it was not the first authorized version.
And there's no official proof that the King James was ever authorized. Authorized meaning that some church group actually sat down and said, okay, and maybe multiple church groups said, we've looked at this, our scholars have looked at it, we think this is the official version. And even though it's printed as back in the... Now, you know, maybe in the 20th century it was authorized, or maybe even in the 19th century it was authorized. But back when it first came out, it was never authorized. Yes.
Yeah, Dennis asked where the King James came from, or where it was translated from. It was the revision of the 1602 bishops, which was, and the effort ended up incorporating more of these Latinisms from the Vulgate, because that's what, actually, William Fulk, back in about 1585, when he made that parallel column revision, or excuse me, parallel column of the Rem's New Testament and the Bishop's New Testament, and the arguments back and forth between Fulk and Gregory Martin in Rem's, and France, it just brought more of the Latinism, so we have more... more Catholic, so to speak, understanding in the New Testament than we had if we had stuck with Tyndale.
Yeah. Well, what happened, I mean, and let's be honest about this, when the King James translators did that, they were still very familiar with Latin. In the days when the King James was done, the language of all the schools basically was Latin. If you went to any of the higher level schools, all your classes were taught in Latin. So when they're translating, quote, from Greek into modern English, well, in those days it was modern English, what we call the King James English today, when they did that translation, if they ran across some Greek that they didn't understand, where do you think they turned to? Latin. So there's lots of places in the King James where we don't have what the Hebrew says, we don't have what the Greek says in the King James. What we have is... And I'm not accusing these guys. They did the best they could under the circumstances, but what they took was the Latin that they understood, and there it is in our King James.
The King James authorized version is a reference to the fact that King James was the one who authorized this.
Yeah.
He was disgusted with all this bickering among these Christians, and he was the one who formed the committee and actually paid for the committee to do that work, to come up with a version that they wouldn't argue about.
Yeah. Theoretically, the King James was supposed to stop the arguments between Protestants and Catholics. It was supposed to be a version that was acceptable to both. And, yeah, it was authorized by the king, never authorized by any church. Okay? So, up looking here in the middle of number 20, Jerome got very tired of responding to critics and developed a very sharp pen and a hot temper in these letters. The conservative Christians and pastors of his day, like others in more recent times, wanted to hang on to the old versions because they were familiar and somehow seemed to be more holy than the new translation. So, Jerome himself finally died in AD 420. He never seemed to get past the criticisms during his lifetime. But the excellent quality of his work into very idiomatic Latin eventually won the day. Now let's talk about what we mean by that. When we say a translation is idiomatic, what do we mean by that? Make sure we're all on the same page here. Yeah. Larry.
I would be using the common language of the everyday person and the colloquialism and how people talk in the marketplace.
Yeah. So the idea here that he was trying to duplicate, or that he was trying to do, was being quite familiar with the Hebrew, being quite familiar with the Greek, he would read the original, hopefully with an understanding close to what the original author intended in that language, and then he would say, okay, now how would I say that in good, high-quality Latin? And in modern terms, that would be called a paraphrase. So the Latin Vulgate, strictly speaking, is somewhere between a translation and a paraphrase. Okay? It's idiomatic Latin. Good quality. And that's the way a translation should be. It should be written in a language that's the common language that people are familiar with, that they feel comfortable with. It feels like God is speaking to them in their language. That's what the Bible is supposed to be like. So, let's see. It became... I'm sorry?
A good translation or a good paraphrase?
Well, you can't translate without paraphrasing. And you don't... A good translation is a paraphrase that doesn't get too far away from the original. Okay? So if you want me to try to put it in my words. Yes, Jerry.
Well, the biggest problem with these, with translating idiomatic expressions is how do you capture the flavor of that? Every language has idiomatic expressions.
That's right. And the flavor of that language.
And so how do you take what is in one language and put it into, and you usually can't put it into an idiomatic phrase. You just have to say what
come
it means.
Come close. Yeah, you come close.
So, you know, we talk about somebody, that's kicked the bucket. That doesn't mean that somebody actually swung their foot and hit a bucket with their toe.
Yeah.
That's, if you were to translate it literally, you would not capture its meaning.
Well, and let me illustrate that, if you will allow me. I will tell you about one of the sins of my past. I had never, ever attended a theater when I was young. It was absolutely forbidden in my family. I mean, you'd get kicked out of the church by going to the theater. When I had graduated from college and was fully trained as a pastor, etc., I traveled with a young man to Europe. And we happened to be in Stockholm one weekend. We were working in Germany and we'd traveled off to Stockholm. We found out that this old film that you probably have all seen at some time in the ancient past, produced in the 60s, called It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, about a bunch of people chasing, hopefully finding some buried treasure somewhere and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, one person knew where this treasure was hidden. And he escaped from prison because he was a criminal, obviously, was racing down this windy mountain road, went off the edge by mistake, bang, 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 down the side of the thing. And it's Jimmy Durante, if you can imagine. And he gets thrown out of the car and he's lying on this rock, you know, at a funny angle. And the people who had no idea who he was or anything about his story rushed down the hill to see what anybody was survived or what had happened in this accident. And they get to him and he's moaning and groaning and he makes a few comments about where the treasure is buried. And they know nothing at all what he's talking about. But he just mentions something about the treasure is buried, whatever, like this. And then he moans and then all of it, his leg is cramped around like this. And just to fit with Jerry's story here, his leg is cramped at a funny angle and all of a sudden he moans and he's straightens his leg out like this, and of course there's a bucket balanced right on the edge of the rock out there in the middle of no man's land, and the bucket goes crash, 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 crash down the hill. Well,
so does that mean then he bought the farm?
Yeah, he bought the farm. But the interesting part of the story, to try to illustrate your point, is this. there were enough people in Sweden who spoke pretty good English that they left the English language. It was dubbed in Swedish, but the English language was playing. That's of course why we went and saw it, and we listened to all this language stuff, and we were just enjoying this picture. And when this guy straightens his leg out and kicks a bucket and goes crashing down the hill, one of the people who had rushed down there just in a deadpan voice says, "I guess he kicked the bucket." You know, and the two of us are just busting our seams laughing, and everybody's looking at us. You know, because the idiom didn't mean anything to them. They didn't know about the idiom. See, and this is the illustration of the idiom thing. And they're looking at us, "Where did you come from? What's that all about?" Yes.
Or drink the Kool-Aid. How many people in this campus would know what drink the Kool-Aid comes from?
Yeah. So, and you know, bought the farm and all that kind of, there are all kinds of idiom ideas like that, that if you're going to translate adequately, what you try to do is capture an idiom from the other language, which basically presents the same idea. Yes. Dennis.
I read an article that was discussing the today's English version of the Good News Bible, mm-hmm. and it was saying that it was translated using using a form of dynamic equivalence, meaning that the reader should come to the same understanding and impression that the reader of the original language.
Exactly, that's the goal.
Okay, would you apply that term? Do people apply that term, dynamic equivalence, to Jerome's Bible?
That's what we mean when we talk about he translated into what were the words here? Very idiomatic Latin. That's what we mean. It's a dynamic equivalent. Instead of trying to translate each word just boom, boom, boom like that and ending up with, you know, nonsense, you try to make very readable, understandable language that ordinary people can understand in the new language. Yeah, that's dynamic equivalence if you like. Okay. So Jerome's Bible became the Bible of the Western world for the next 1,000 years. In all the long history of translations into various languages, only the Septuagint has had more influence. Another correction we need to make. See, I didn't get it. Didn't get this done in time to have Gordon look at it for me. Has been more influential than Jerome's Latin Vulgate. I guess that is correct, I'm sorry. But as you might guess, the old Latin continued to be used side by side with Jerome's new translation. This led to corruption of one by the other and vice versa. So now we not only have, notice what we've got. If we all could read Latin, if we had the Latin Bible in front of us here, we would have the Book of Psalms, which is translated not from the Hebrew, but from the Greek with a sideways glance at Origen's critical work. We would have the Apocrypha in the middle, parts of which he translated from the Aramaic, not from the Hebrew, but from the Aramaic, because there's no Hebrew original for those books. We would have some books that he refused to translate at all, so the church just picked some from somewhere and stuck it in there. And so part of the Apocrypha is from there. Then we would have the last half of the New Testament that was not translated by Jerome, but more or less supervised by Jerome. He just sort of said, well, you know, let's try to make it as close to the Greek as we can. And so that happened there. And then he goes back to the Old Testament and he's translating there sort of, you know, for his own personal use, and he sends copies to his friends kind of a thing. And we put all that together, and this hodgepodge we call a Latin Bible, the Vulgate, the common translation for the people. That's what the church used for thousands of years, for 1,000 years. And I should say the point there in number 22 is that people still use the old translations. There were lots and lots of them around, so they still used it. And so later people who copied would say, well, this is what Jerome says, but maybe I like what it says over here in somebody's old Latin. I like that better, so I'll put that in. And so pretty soon, there was sharing back and forth between Jerome's translation and the old Latin. One important fact sticks out regarding the Latin Vulgate by Jerome. Because a single man was the primary contributor to the entire Bible, it has a pretty good consistency throughout. So that's one of the major positives about the Vulgate. He made sure that the prophecies, and this is another thing he did. Notice this, very interesting. We've talked about Christians trying to make the Bible fit Christianity and the Jews trying to make their Old Testament, I mean their Bible not fit Christianity. They're trying to argue with Christians. Well, here's a very specific example, just to show you some of what he did. He made sure that the prophecies from the Old Testament had the same wording in their translation in Latin as the fulfillments in the New. So Isaiah 7:14, for example, has Virgo in Latin, or virgin in English, to accord with fulfillment in Matthew, where it does say Parthenos in Greek, which means virgin, literally a virgin, rather than young woman, which is what the Hebrew original says. So you see what's going on here? Because Jerome is familiar with the fulfillments of prophecies in the New Testament, he says, when I go back here and translate the Old Testament, instead of trying to be very, you know, committed to what this says exactly in the Old Testament, I'm going to make this sound as close as I can to what happens over here in the New Testament. So when you read this in the Old Testament, then you go over and you read this in the New Testament, aha, it must be a fulfillment because it's the exact same words. Right? And so there's some of that went on. Okay? So efforts are underway to produce a critical edition of the Old Latin. And I haven't checked whether parts of it have been done. I don't know whether they finished it or not, because a critical edition of the Old Latin and the Vulgate, putting them both together. But this is a real challenge because there are no less than 8,000, and I'm sure there's a lot more than that by now, but in the book I was looking at, 8,000 copies of various kinds in libraries in Europe. And you can imagine trying to compare, if you stop and think about this, trying to take entire Bibles or even portions of Bibles, 8,000 of them, and trying to make a comparison and trying to include in the footnotes every possible variation in 8,000 manuscripts. I mean, this is a horrendous job. Okay. Well, the earliest Latin translation that we have available today of Jerome's Bible in its completeness comes from the 6th century. So we don't even have a Bible that's in the last, 100 years. The earliest ones we have is 100 years after Jerome died, basically. So there's that problem as well. The Latin Bible, mostly Jerome's Vulgate translation, was the first book ever to be printed by movable type. So, you know, we sometimes don't stop and think about it. I've had people who think, oh, Gutenberg printed the first Bible? How was his English? No. Gutenberg was a German, and he's printing in Latin. It was regarded as the Bible of those days. The Bible had to be read in Latin. That was the idea. Okay? So he just, when he decided what he was going to print, he wanted to pick out something that was really important, something people would remember. So what does he print? He prints the Latin Bible. However, the Gutenberg Bible was published between 1452 and 1456. It was an incredible achievement. Let's not knock it in any way. But as a presentation of the Latin Bible, it had many, many errors. Gutenberg had his hands full producing a new technology without doing a critical study of the Latin text. When Protestants began to challenge the Roman Catholic Church in the 16th century, now this is 100 years after Gutenberg, Catholics responded in turn by declaring, for the first time, the Latin Vulgate to be the authoritative Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, as far as they were concerned, of all Christians. So now, you don't have to worry about what the Hebrew says. You don't have to worry about what the Greek says. You don't have to worry about where all this came from or how it came about. The Church has put its stamp of approval on this Latin translation, and that is the Bible of Christianity. That was their attitude. So, and this led to one of the Catholic bishops putting together the Complutense in Polyglot. Some of you have heard about it, a lot of different No, I'm sorry. It wasn't the Complutensian Polyglot. It was a different one. Anyway, he did a thing where he had Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. He said, well, okay, let's look at all these languages side by side. So in the Old Testament, it was Hebrew, Latin in the middle, and the Greek. And his comment was this: I give you the Latin between the Hebrew and the Greek as Christ was crucified between two thieves. That was their attitude. And many of the people who accepted the Septuagint felt the same way about it. You know, we know God better now than those people knew him back then, and so our translation of the original is better than the original. That's literally what they believed. Okay, our time is basically out. Any comments before we finish this? Yes. Oh, hold on. There's a microphone coming. Everybody wants to hear you. Right beside you there.
No, I just want to know about what does Orthodox mean?
Orthodox, the word literally means straight language or straight teaching. That's what it literally means. And Orthodox usually means it's been approved by the church hierarchy. It means some church group has said, this is the gospel.
So why some churches are called Orthodox?
Well, because someone thought they were more middle of the road than some other groups.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Technically, the opposite of orthodox is heretical. If you're a heretic, you're not orthodox. If you're not a heretic and you believe God the way everybody else thinks you should, then you're orthodox.
Oh, okay.
Jerry.
Originally, the term orthodox was applied to the group that was in the majority.
Yeah.
And the heretics was applied, the term heretics was applied to those who were in the minority.
Sure.
It didn't have any implications of being right or wrong. It was just an association with which group, the dominant or the minority group
you were
with.
No. That's not correct.
If you're more powerful,
then you're right. That was the way it was in those days.
No. Later on, that became that way. By the time we get to the 16th century, certainly it had taken on that flavor.
Yeah.
But originally, as those words were applied to the groups who took different positions on Arianism and Gnosticism and so on, it was just these were different groups. And one was Orthodox because it was dominant, not because it was right.
Yeah, but at the same time, let's be clear that if they were in the majority and they said it should be this way, as far as they were concerned, they were right. I mean,
let me say it wasn't an issue of
righteousness. Yeah, okay. If the term is righteousness, yeah, that's a different story. Okay, we got to wind up. Did you have a final comment?
Just look at how many years. It's only been a few years since the Bible was put into print. I mean, the Bible has a huge, lengthy history before that, and we seem to forget about that.
Yep. That's the reason we're doing this class. Okay, let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, we once again thank you for the incredible efforts you must have gone through to preserve this record in as pure a form as we have it today. It's remarkable that we can take our Bible and open it and read and say, this is God's Word. We're not trying to be critical in any way. We're just trying to understand the true story about how it all came to us. Help us today that we may find the time to study it carefully, to try to understand it with the blessings, the enormous blessings that we have today of so many translations and so many different understandings to try to broaden our perspective. May we find the best possible ways to understand it and to tell it to others is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.